Yeah, I was thinking about, I was at a sesshin years ago with my Jukai teacher. I don't want to use her name here, but John knows her. And she asked me what I was doing in Zazen, and I said, oh, I'm roaming and playing. And she said, you're what? And I said, I'm roaming and playing in Zazen. I read about that. And she said, where? And I said, on the internet. And she said, I don't think that's real Zen. Michael Gay, and if you know her, she has this look that she can give you, and when she gives you that look, it just stops you cold. And so I kind of made it through that, changed my tactics, and then we got this book, and I opened it up, and I was reading for what I was going to talk about. And I found this, and I'll kind of start out with, this is by Hongzhi Zhengwei. With total trust, roam and play in samadhi. So I finally found it. Empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine, this is how to strike down and fold up the remaining habits of many lives. When you turn within and drop off everything completely, realization occurs. Roam and play in samadhi. Every detail appears before you. Sound and form, echo and shadow, all happen instantly without leaving traces. The outside and myself do not dominate each other. Only because no perceiving of objects comes between us. So suddenly I now really like Hongzhi. And we haven't really talked all that much about him. I think Cliff mentioned that he started his studies at 7. He was ordained at 11, and he died in Zazen. Just right in the middle of the period, they found him dead, completely upright. So I like that. And I kind of wondered, with this silent illumination, what is it exactly? So looking at it, what I found is, and we talked about some of this along the way, but it's kind of defined as radical, refined non-dualism, which means at that time, he was the first to articulate silent illumination, or what we now call shikantaza. So it's kind of a major shift. And at that time, most meditation was focused on an object, either a mantra, something in the room, and you would really concentrate on this one thing. And there was a growing movement of people who were thinking maybe a wider, expansive view. Rather than focusing on one thing, we kind of want to receive the whole world. So he called it silent illumination, and its purpose was to apprehend all phenomena, which is the world we see, our senses, and the five skandhas, as one unified totality. So separating the idea of me and it, object and subject. There's a focus in Hongzhi Zen on active insight and serenity. He says you need these two things. You need to be calm, and you need to be curious. You need to keep looking into his idea is we sit down, we create stillness, and then we get curious about the world, and we listen, and this is going to die. One moment. Okay. Hongzhi, like Dogen, left a lot of specific instructions, and they were mainly written, as we've seen, in holographic or poetic language, where the instructions try to be clear, but because we're talking about the absolute world, he needs to evoke rather than explain most of the time. But for most of the people writing at the time, he's clearer than most. At one point, he writes, "Respond unencumbered to each speck of dust, without becoming his partner. The subtlety of seeing and hearing transcends mere colors and sounds." So that's probably, to me, it's a little more clear than Dogen. And so his style is fairly simple. He's very clear that he believes that there's no permanent enlightenment, that we can't reach some state beyond what we have now. We can have serenity. We can modify what we already have, but we cannot become something else. We remain human, and we remain what we are. So his emphasis is on just sitting, where we just sit. We meet the immediate presence in this world, and just this, and which means just what we have here now. So we're not looking for flashy experience or anything more than right here, right now. His practice is bodhisattvic, which means it's not about sitting, attaining bliss, and staying where we are. He's constantly exhorting us to do the work in Zazen, and then go out in the world in some way. And his way in the world was in a monastery, but the size of his monastery during his abbacy grew from 300 to 1,000 students in the monastery. So he was, for a teacher, that's pretty well in the world. I mean, he had a fairly busy day, I imagine. In practice, he emphasized that the pivotal move is the backward step. And that comes up again and again. And in looking at this, it fascinated me that the backward step is, in Japanese, is called Eko Hensho, and it's a meditation technique, which I thought it was something magical that happened, but according to Dan Lagan, it's a specific technique, and the Dogen wrote that whenever a thought occurs, be aware of it. As soon as you're aware of it, it will vanish. If you remain for a long period forgetful of objects, you will naturally become unified. This is the essential art of Zazen. So, that came up, and it was interesting to me. He's got a real Hongzhi has a pretty large emphasis on wonder, which I like. His first instruction ends with, accordingly, with thoughts clear, sitting silently, wandering to the center of this circle of wonder. This is how you must penetrate and study. Wonder is mentioned 18 times in this book. It comes up again and again. And the other thing I like him is Hongzhi pretty clearly thinks when you read him for a while that Zen ought to be fun sometimes and that it ought to be beautiful. He kind of has the idea that if you haven't got any wonder going on and you're not seeing beauty, you're not really doing Zazen. So I kind of agree with that. So I'm talking with a room full of priests, and I'm curious about it's the last day of Zazen. So I'm kind of wondering kind of what's going on for you guys. So I thought this might be better as a discussion rather than a talk. That I've told you what I've learned about Hongzhi. My instruction that I want to share with you and talk about is called Investigating Wonder. And I'm wondering what wonder means in your Zazen and how you've experienced it this week or ongoing. And it reads, in clarity, the wonder exists. With spiritual energy shining on its own, it cannot be grasped and so cannot be called being. It cannot be rubbed away and so cannot be called non-being. Beyond the mind of deliberation and discussion, it departs from the remains of shadowy images. Emptying one's sense of self-existence is wondrous. This wonder is embodied with a spirit that can be enacted and invoked. The moon mind, with its cloud body, is revealed straightforwardly in every direction, without resorting to signs or symbols. Radiating light everywhere, it responds appropriately to beings and enters the sense it does without confusion. Overcoming every instruction, it shines through every empty dharma, leaving discriminating conditioning, inner clean, clear wisdom, and romp and play in samadhi. What could be wrong? This is how one must genuinely investigate the essence. So I'm curious what you think.
Yeah. I think for me, the sense of wonder is no different than the middle way path. And what I mean by that is it's not getting caught up in the absolute or the relative. And what happens in that place is there is this subtle radiance that Hongzhi speaks about. Mm-hmm. But yet it's not the sort of thing that calls forth any attaching or turning away from. It's just everywhere we turn, whatever comes up in our Zazen, there's subtle radiance. Yeah. And so that's how we can travel this realm of emptiness without falling into nihilism, because clearly, you know, this existence is here, but it's just here in a very different way. From the way we all too often experience it. So that's where the wonder comes in, because I don't have to define it and separate it out from something else to define what this is. It's just radiating subtly along with all other beings. And if that does, that creates wonder for me.
What is wonder?
Well, we talked about it a little bit during my talk. It has to begin with that not knowing, because what kills wonder is, as soon as we have just this total knowledge of something, if I relate it to mystery, which they're near relatives. They're not exactly the same, I don't think, because wonder is pointing to something more boundless, whereas mystery could just be a mystery story, or going to a play. If you know who did it, the mystery's killed, right? You know. But if you don't know, now there's mystery. And if we expand that sense of mystery to all things, now we've made that subtle shift from mystery to wonder. Although the mysterious is often used by the mystics, and mysticism is derived from that term. So it's very much about not knowing and being comfortable in our place, in our experience, without needing to know. Because ultimately, if we look deep within, our need to know is our need to control. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need to control things so they don't surprise us, right? Mm-hmm. We don't like surprises. We want to know. We want to be in control. So to live in wonder is to be subject to surprises, too, and to enjoy them.
So, wonder can also be egocentric, and when you're on the hunt, you know, there's a real sense of wonder about that, going down some dark alleys to find what you're after or to investigate. Mm-hmm. So, it's not just egoless wonder. Because maybe we have to go down, and our passions with all of that too. You know, I think we were talking about the samadhi wonder, which is different than, the physical world is a wondrous place for those of us that are curious about all sorts of things, and there's a lot of, I want to try that one, you know, kind of stuff. So,
right.
Or wouldn't that look good on me? Or I need that tool, you know, and there's a wonder about it, and how am I going to get it, and how am I going to put it to work? And so so wonder works that way too, I think, and maybe helps us into action and trouble, which is useful because then you can see you're in trouble and work your way out of it.
I think the really great scientists have that sense of wonder to them, and it comes through loud and clear. Someone like an Einstein, an obvious example. I mean, that just was very much part of.
Well, we got some scientists here. What does the scientific sense of wonder feel like?
Good question. Well, I think it's you have to be driven by the wonder for nature, and you know. Even if in modern scientists that they detach a bit from the sacred view, like people like me, they don't. I see true nature, the sacred presence of reality and the mystery behind that. But even if they don't, you still have the wonder of, wow, what's behind? I'm discovering something new. I mean, I'm unlocking the book of reality and life. So you have to, without that, you can't really do science, because it's very demanding. So why you should, like, work 20 hours, not sleep, and spend your life after something that you don't know? So, and it's interesting, because sometimes that drives people to a more spiritual vision of reality. You start very rationally, and then you find yourself in a more mystic realm. So wonder is very important. In either way, it's left and right brain.
Jerry. You asked what we were doing this week.
Yeah.
My attention came to focus on the upright cauldron and identifying the somatic sense of my posture with the upright cauldron. Mm-hmm.
How's that work? How's that work?
Well, I wanted to mention that in response to what you asked. But the main point that I wanted to was this and business of the backward step. That's been something that I've been trying to appreciate, because I didn't have a very good sense of what it is. Now, the passage that you wrote from Dogen's first version of the Fukan Zazen is taken from an older Chinese text, which Dogen later repudiates, pretty much. And in his later version, the one that we chant, it's a koan. How do you think? Non-thinking.
Yeah.
Not thinking. That passage that you read is gone, and the koan is the present one. In reading, trying to understand what the backward step is, the closest I could get was, I forget whether it was Seke Hirata Roshi and some of the other translations or commentaries on Fukan Zazen, he says, just letting the mind be what it is. Or at least that's how they translate that portion of Dogen.
Yeah.
The closest I can get to the backward step is asking the question, where am I? Is that me? So I've come to, and I still haven't made it mine yet.
Yeah.
But I've come to sense of it as, you know, when something reflects in the mirror, there is nothing reflecting and no one to see the reflection. So I think it's going toward that point. Where is the I in this? Where am I? Who am I? But now, that's a long discourse. I don't mean to say that I know very much about it. And I brought it up in this way really to ask your opinion about that, because that also seems to be an important point in what Hongxi means by this really diving into the illumination.
Yeah.
How do you understand the backward step?
When I first saw it, like we were chanting, you know, and it went across the chant card, and the words just leapt off the page. There was just something about it that just rang true, and so the feeling is like in those moments when I'm there, those words really fit. It's like, sometimes it feels like I'm almost stepping back and things open, and so I wonder what it is. I've asked a lot of teachers that question, and so it was interesting to me that at Hongxi's time it seemed to be the name of a technique. But now in our time, it's grown into a more poetic instruction. And so what it is there's, to me, there's these moments of letting go. And, you know, I'm kind of reaching a point in my practice where I can intentionally do some of that, but I'm no longer sure what's happening. You know, I can just feel kind of, it feels like a shearing. You know, like I got on a plane. I have a phobia of planes, really serious phobia. And then, like, I could step out of that. But how do you do that? Does that answer your question, or maybe?
It's a communication between us. That is, I have a little bit more of a sense of your approach to it, which is what I was asking, but I can't say that I understood very well
what it is,
because you're not you're mentioning something which I'm sure is true in an immediate experience, which you identify with stepping back, stepping with the backward step,
right.
I presume. But you haven't conveyed to me, or I haven't been able to appreciate very much more than that you are onto something.
So is your question what or how or...
Well, you, as you say, it's a difficult question. You've asked yeah. many teachers.
Yeah.
And through your practice, you're at least beginning to have a sense of what this could mean or maybe does mean.
Yeah.
But I... That doesn't help me too much to
maybe.
Appreciate more... how I can approach doing the backward step.
Maybe it might help to ask, step back from where? Where do we step back from?
Being me.
Stepping, add something?
Only a response to that response. I think I have experiences like along the lines of what Joe was talking about, but I would that. Taking a backward step seems to be the a good word, good phrase for it. In the way that I experience it is not so dissociative. It's not like I'm not me for a while. I don't feel as if it's like that. It is a maybe. I like the imagery of a circle because it does feel like a bit of a widening of the attention. Where, so the from, stepping back from, I suppose is stepping back from a narrower perspective, and being the kind of analytical capacity of ego or of self. That's the that's kind of the that could be the center of the circle, but the wider view is actually the sunlight and the trees and the birds. So here in the Sendo, I hear the birds a lot, and they help. They actually help me a lot to shift my awareness. So it's almost. It's not backwards in that, because backwards was is like in one direction, but it's like in all directions. So it's maybe taking the specificity out of perception. It's not as specifically the small localized perception which is doing the perceiving. It's actually everything is perceiving.
Good. I was wondering, listening to what you said, I was wondering if this backward step could also be associated with before, like they say, before thought,
mm-hmm.
or before conceptualization, or before making a self. But before implies time. Backward implies space, right? So we're kind of working with...
Or time.
Yeah.
But it does
or
imply
time.
Directionality.
Yeah, yeah, directionality. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought about that, too, the kind of physical... I was wishing that I spoke Japanese or knew what the original phrase was because of whether stepping backwards was... Which aspects of the original concept are captured in the translation stepping backwards, and if there are other possible translations of it, because it does imply directionality. And so the physical action of stepping backwards feels almost like this dissociative thing in a way. Like, if you were literally, I don't know, to step backwards, you would, I suppose, as if you could be disembodied, you would see yourself sitting there. And you would see your body sitting there doing zazen from the back.
On the other hand, if you were moving forward, stepping back would actually be, might be called stopping, right? Mm-hmm. In a sense, like you stop your forwardness of making a self, or you know, creating the story of you meeting the world or whatever. So that stops, say in a breath in zazen, it stops. Because that could be, that stopping itself could be backward from the sense of I'm always moving toward making me.
In Iyengar yoga, that's that school of yoga that I learned for a while, and they ask in a standing posture, in Tadasana, they ask you to lean forward onto your toes and then to lean backward onto your heels, and to observe the difference in how it feels. And they encourage you to stand back on your heels, because this is engaging the visual field. It's actually promotes an excited mind. You're extending yourself in what's next. And in this other action, literally
it places
shifting
you.
Your weight to the back. They say shifting your weight to the back body is how they say it. It actually is associated with a calmer mental activity. From our past, they say passive mind. They say passive mind. I don't know. We would probably say passive self, but
that's associated with our posture. That's good.
It's interesting because in the 70s was the first year I was around people that wore earth shoes. And earth shoes are that your heel is lower. And they very much, and most of them were very much into doing yoga, and yoga that's very much with the alignment, is keeping, you know, the stretch and the posture and I want to say, when you talked about taking the backward step and you used the word open, and my... you know, when I think of stepping back, it's creating space. And when I step back and I create that space, it's space in my practice. It's space in my thinking. You know, instead of having all the storehouse stuff come in right away, yeah. It's creating that space.
Yeah.
You know, we have all the habitual that comes in, but if I take that step, and I do, I find myself more and more where, you know, there'll be something going on, and I just take a step back, you know, and I create that space, and I don't bring all this in to interact with it in the way that, you know, I may have been doing for many, many years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that like ties in kind of with what Jonathan's talking about, stepping out, and there's this what I realized and where this shift occurs is that when I get a sense of it is that, I mean, I know that, like, everything I see is not the actual object. Every sense is my mind. And suddenly, there's this realization, like, I'm located here. It's a guidance system. It's easier to drive a car than operate a radio-controlled car for a lot of things, you know. So it makes sense that I would be located here. But like, everything I see, colors don't exist. It's all a construction. And then once I step back, there's a realization that I'm looking at my mind. That like, everything I see is actually my mind. And then there's this shift, and then things appear softer. They appear less dangerous. And
who's,
there's like...
Who's looking?
What's that?
Who's looking?
It's like combined. You know, I mean, there's my arm and there's this. You know, and there are kind of parts of myself. I mean, there's a shift in perspective, and I don't mean to make this sound mystical at all. It's just suddenly going, oh, wow. You know, if we're talking, I realize, oh, I'm not, like, Jonathan isn't doing anything to me right now. I'm doing it. Because I'm making you.
Can I make one?
Yeah.
The sense of that when you're investigating your sensory field, or yeah, looking at your visual field, or listening to your auditory field, that sense that by doing so you're actually just watching your own mind.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
In that, who is watching?
That goes back to my before thought. Like, for a little while, you forget. You know, like when you're watching a movie and then all of a sudden you realize you're in a movie theater. You know, and you're like, oh, I forgot that. But for that time, I was in that movie. I was part of the movie, or the movie. And so when life becomes that real, I mean, that's what I see as wonder.
And then if you turn around and from that place of what is watched,
yeah,
and you ask, who is watching? Mm-hmm. And there's no one there.
Mm-hmm. What's next?
John? Well, maybe this is just too simple, but the next part after that is to turn the light inwardly and illuminate the self, and body and mind drops away.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're looking at this way, as you say, we're making all this, we're perceiving so-called us, we're perceiving this. But when we look inwardly, there is nothing there. That's where we move into the whole world, when the body and the mind falls away, because there isn't someone looking and there's nothing particular to see. So that way, when you turn the light inwardly, when you look in, then the realization of emptiness within the form becomes apparent. And then that's the absolute freedom. You then see your connection, or the connection. You see it's the moon and the dewdrop again. Everything is sitting here. The whole world is sitting here. So it's not one person or me making up perceptions or anything to do with that. So we turn the light inward to illuminate the self. In other words, it's just the mirror. It's mm-hmm. just that beautiful mirror. Yes. And that's the luminous field. So everything can drop away when you look in the way instead of out the way. And of course, there's no one actually either way.
Dogen and Genjo Koan put it very succinctly and directly when he said that the self goes forth to experience the myriad things. That's delusion. But that the myriad things come forth and experience themselves, that's enlightenment. That's intimate accord. Mm-hmm. That's where the experience is. It's the whole shebang. Don't separate ourselves out from that.
Can I introduce an idea?
Yeah.
Something about surrender.
Mm-hmm.
When there's kind of a softening that happens, right? Maybe it's even felt in the body first, like a softening in the body, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that this is relevant to your question about wonder, because I think that wonder has two responses. Wonder is the feeling of, is kind of feeling of awe, right?
Yeah.
And there's two responses to that feeling of awe, and one is surrender. And actually the other is the one that Doug suggested, right? The scientist, the scientific impulse is the other response. Let me see what's behind that, you know, let me delineate, let me cook something up, you know, let me dig that rock out of the ground. So I think that that wonder itself is the experience that creates the awe, and from it there are maybe many possible impulses, but the softer one is the surrender, you know. It's actually the comfort in the discomfort of
surrender to what? So could you qualify that just a little bit? Surrender to the experience? Surrender to the noticing? How would you say it?
I guess it's the ego stepping back, saying, actually, I don't need to run the show right now. So it's this surrendering is done by the ego, or that what I mean by ego here is the impulse to
identify,
grasp,
yeah.
turnover, look, yeah.
Yeah.
So surrendering by that surrendering of that impulse, and it's why it's a softening, because that
the
impulse can actually miss, you know, it might actually come up, but it can miss.
Because it's an antidote to the kind of grasping or holding of identity, or what is
asking. It's like I don't know how that happens, and I know that the groundwork is like what I'm doing now is like how relax. You know, I used to have first I had to build the upright posture, you know, and like actually this question goes way back before Zen too. You know, it's really what brought me to Zen. You know, it came in the form of how do I let go? I was trying to let go, but it was very clear to me that letting go was like one of those paddles with the ball and the rubber band, you know, and you hit the ball and that was about all I could do, and that was letting go, you know, in my 20s. And
great metaphor.
And so I just did that. It's like, how do I get this ball?
Sometimes you miss and the ball comes back.
Yeah. But there's never a good outcome here. So...
it's like the Marsh Brothers again.
We're back to the Marsh Brothers.
Those are the Three Stooges.
So the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Well, that is my sort of main concern. Now, I mentioned the upright cauldron.
Yeah.
The posture. The sameness, or the effort in the uprightness, or the sensation of the uprightness. But with respect to my mind attitude,
yeah.
Since long ago I had some sense of Gengo Koan, all things are me,
mm-hmm.
my yeah. mind stopping,
yeah.
all these good things, which I can identify and which we talked about extensively. And I wanted them again.
Yeah.
And I wanted them.
Yeah.
And for 30 years, I tried to get them.
Yeah.
Now, with enough practice, of course,
yeah.
Some of this becomes internalized. You don't see it.
Yeah.
Maybe you feel it with our yoga, the forms, or the liturgy, or just your own motion sometime during a session. But I couldn't get it. And I still can't get it.
Yeah.
So more and more, my effort and more this session is, I really don't know.
Yeah.
The only thing I can do, or can try to do, is not try to get anything.
Yeah.
And just be with my mind. And it seems, I mean, I don't project outward into something which is objective and neutral, looking back at me, sort of like Mach's principle.
Yeah.
I don't do that anymore. For a while, I thought I could project this outward into other people and see myself disappear.
Yeah,
that didn't work. So now I'll just have to see and sit upright and look at my mind. And, you know, so why practice? Because you can't believe that there's nothing else to get and you're already there. And that requires a certain continuous effort.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the illumination is gone. So there's some, I guess, some sort of continuous effort that's needed just to just to believe that there's really no place to go, no dusty lands to go off to search for. So now I'm not trying to grasp it.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to see it. And I have to be careful not to throw out the enlightenment, because surely Buddhism wouldn't exist without enlightenment. So it's got to be an important point. So now I don't know. I'm lucky to be with you all. Be able to speak with Mike from time to time. But I'm more at sea in a certain way than I've ever been, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, have you noticed how much we like our problems? Why? Because I get better at letting go of things, because it's much better than 25, but it's like the last 6 months or so. I've just been noticing I now can, for the first time in my life, go to sleep any time I want, but I will still stay up 2 hours knowing full well all I've got to do is do this, this, and this, and I'll go to sleep. But my mind, it's like I'll start doing that, and a minute later, the problems, you know, I just grab that problem back. Have you noticed that? It's hilarious. I think the answer's in there somewhere. Or at least not the answer, because it's always the next step.
What did you say?
Oh, there's something there. There's something there. Noticing that. I'm just wondering, because you've been practicing a long time. Do you ever notice that?
What?
Just how much the mind likes its problems.
Well, certainly I do. play with these things which keep me awake.
Uh-huh.
In that regard, I think more of the difficulties we have in giving up really bad habits, because they make us secure.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had a bad habit for a long time, it'd be very difficult to give up, because you know that as long as you're doing it, you'll stay alive. You're okay. You're secure with it. So it's very difficult to change. And one of the benefits of practicing the Sangha is you can see other people go through such experiences. They can tell you they're going nuts. Worst thing that's ever happened to me. I just can't stand it. I'm out of here. And you can see that there's a better light in their eyes and they're functioning more normally, and you say, hey, they're better. Hey, good going. They're looking great. Mm-hmm. They're going nuts because they're shifting from some pattern of behavior which they're secure with.
Yeah.
And then when you've seen that a few times, when it happens to you, you can say, hey, I think I've seen that before. Maybe I can have a little bit of confidence.
I like your use of the word secure. I think that's an interesting word to use for, it's like safe.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have what we feel safe with and we grasp onto. And hold on to.
Yeah, it seems like myself is always trying to prove its existence.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Just by being in opposition to things.
That's the fundamental problem. It's always trying to fortify itself. The ego. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's when you. When you see this open field thing, it's not comfortable. It feels like the bottom has dropped out, and it's very, for me, it's unfamiliar and uncomfortable. And I feel kind of lost, And despite this sense, there's like a very kind of warm, pleasant, soft sense associated with it. There's such a habit of reinforcing that sense of self, So for me, it comes up, and it sounds like for you, it's like problems, right? It is the presence of your mind dealing with problems that sort of reinforces that you exist, that it's there. For me, oftentimes it's like physics problems.
Yeah.
My mind just starts doing, either writing computer programs or thinking about plasmas or something. But it's like, that's such a strong habit, and it happens. I've noticed it very poignantly during the session because I've had more experiences of openness, of empty attention, than normal, and seeing that that response to it I feel like I have the same kind of hilarity about it that you're pointing out. Just like, well, isn't that funny? Why so uncomfortable with this?
Yeah.
But it's so quick, And I do, and I think the language to describe that phenomenon is that fortification, of attachment, clinging to self. Basically, all that figuring out that I'm doing in my mind, or the figuring out that you're talking about, I believe is like a manifestation of clinging to self, where things are comfortable, because those are, the more
control.
Yeah.
So just taking the step back then throw you off balance.
Yes, I feel like I'm dizzy. Yes.
And maybe that's helpful, though. Is it
to be off balance? Or
well, when you're fortifying your existence because of conflict, and you take a step back, there is a shift of balance in that, an actual probably physical shift, and that's why that meditation technique is probably useful too to explore.
Well, and taking that step back takes trust. You know, trust in yourself. Trust in yourself and belief in your practice. You know, it's...
What self are you trusting in?
Hmm?
What self are you trusting in?
Well, that's true. What self are you trusting?
And what's this mind everybody's talking about? So that wonderful story I have no memory for. Names, but maybe Bodhidharma or somebody. Somebody went up and said, my mind is driving me crazy. It's doing
right,
all these
right.
things. Please fix my mind, please. And he goes, okay, I'll fix your mind. Give it to me.
Yeah, bring me your mind.
Never mind.
Right.
I think that's the backward step. Never mind.
But there is trust also. There's, you know, Dogen talks about great faith, right?
Yeah.
And great doubt. And
but it's
they,
not
yeah.
in anything.
But
no,
maybe
it's not
in anything.
Like, no.
But do you think maybe that faith is the same faith that Cynthia's referring to?
Yeah.
Whatever
that's,
it is.
No, because that's where I learned it. That's where I read about it.
We have faith, but it's not in anything. We have trust, but it's not in anything.
Yeah, having, you
it's
know,
nothing
that,
for it to depend on.
Yeah.
Project.
Yeah, having faith in your practice. You know, that I remember when I read about that, and I was like, whoa. Which is, you mean, you know, it really kind of threw me. But then I wrote, and, you know. Yeah.
The thing is, on a much more personal and less metaphysical level, there is confidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can encounter, you know, when you encounter a person with confidence, they make you feel comfortable, right? And so there's that kind of, there is also that kind of confidence. Which I think is connected to this other kind of faith or confidence, you know, comfort in the world.